I was completely sedated and in a coma on the 9th, and I didn't wake up until the 20th.
A near-death experience with H1N1 flu. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 2nd of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Anchorage police track an alarming rise in heroin use among young people.
It's shocking what we're seeing. Lots of people that we've arrested don't have a criminal history.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com.
A Prince of Wales woman is recovering after an encounter with swine flu that left her on the brink of death. Most cases in Alaska have not been so serious. KRBD's Deanna Garrison reports.
On August 1st, 38-year-old Hollis resident Heidi Williams thought she might be catching a chest cold after waking up with a tight chest. Having never had any major medical problems in the past, Williams says she had no idea what she was in for. By the following week, she was battling a high-grade fever, nausea, a severe case of pneumonia, and swine flu, although she wouldn't be diagnosed with swine flu until much later. At that point, she decided to seek medical attention.
I went into Search and Kluwak on Friday the 7th, and I don't remember falling asleep that night. And I guess on Saturday, my children and my mom and stepfather and brothers had come to see me in the emergency room at Search and Kluwak, and I don't remember talking to them at all. And then I don't remember any of the medevac on Sunday to Ketchikan, and they intubated me at some point within a few hours, I believe, of being in Ketchikan. So I was completely sedated and in a coma, in an induced coma, on the 9th, and I didn't wake up until the 20th.
Williams woke up in bed at the intensive care unit of the University of Washington Hospital with tubes down her throat and on a respirator.
And that was a really scary, traumatic experience because, you know, I woke up, I didn't know where I was, and none of my family was there when I woke up. I made it through that whole experience that was scary, and it seemed like within an hour of them taking the tubes out, my mom walked in the door, and I just remember saying, "Hi, Mom." Of course, she started crying.
After waking up, Williams learned just how close to death she had been and found out that her parents and family members had been taking turns holding vigil at her bedside.
When they released me into what I call general population, I don't know what the proper term is, but they wheeled me out of my room and through the ICU. And I mean, there's hundreds upon hundreds of people in there, nurses and doctors and just, you know, staff members, and they all knew who I was, and they all stood up and clapped, and they just were, you know, "We can't believe you're already getting out." It was pretty overwhelming, but I guess I was the sickest person for that first week that I was in ICU, other than the terminal patients.
Williams says she was unable to lift her arms, roll over, or get out of bed when she came out of the coma. She says it took her about 5 days before she could walk 5 feet. Williams didn't return to Alaska until September 13th. She still has fluid in her lungs and is battling thyroid problems related to the illness. On top of it, she has $500,000 in medical bills and no health insurance.
That's way more than our house cost. So it just seems like there's no light at the end of the tunnel. There's nothing that we can do about it, and I am alive, and like my husband says, it's better than the alternative.
Well, swine flu cases are being widely reported throughout the country. Most aren't nearly as severe as Williams. Ketchikan General Hospital's Bev Crum says Ketchikan General Hospital began monitoring swine flu cases, or what it calls H1N1, in September.
We've, in the last couple weeks, started to see an increase in the number of patients that are presenting to the emergency department and to the clinics here locally. And it seems, to look at the numbers, it would be, we've kind of broken it out into age groups. And so the age group of 5 to 24 years seems to be the biggest impact for us.
She says the number of cases have run from 4 to 20 weekly, with the total number increasing by a couple of cases each week. Crum says area medical facilities aren't seeing an inordinate amount of flu cases. But she says there are a higher number of flu cases for this time of year than usual. She's recommending that residents who become sick stay home and says hand washing is the number one way to avoid catching the flu. In Ketchikan, I'm Deanna Garrison.
Heroin is on the rise in Anchorage, and drug enforcement officials fear its availability could seep into the bush. In part of an ongoing series, KSKA's Ellen Lockyer examines the alarming increase in the use of heroin among young people in the state's largest city.
On a routine night in Anchorage's gritty Spinard area, there's no telling what you'll find.
I arrested a gal at working Spinard as a prostitute, and when I put the cuffs on her, pat her down, she was wearing Dansko clogs, designer jeans. She had a Starbucks coffee card in her back pocket. That is not something normally that I would see on your average prostitute.
That's Sergeant Kathy Lacey with the Anchorage Police Department's Vice Squad.
Both her parents are teachers, and I said, "What are you doing?" She said, "I got hooked on heroin. I was at a party and somebody gave me heroin to try."
Lacey says heroin is replacing crack as a street drug with disturbing results.
It's shocking what we're seeing. Lots of people that we've arrested don't have a criminal history. You don't usually find that with dealers of cocaine. You know, they've been arrested before. They've had some run-in with law enforcement. But we're seeing a lot of people, young people, that are getting into this.
She says the dealers have changed, too. Of the 60 or so busted this year,
predominantly young white males are the dealers, at least the ones that we're arresting. There's so much money in it now, and there's such a demand for it.
The drug has been around a long time and has many street names, Smack, Horse, China White, but heroin by any other name would be as deadly. Heroin is a painkiller of mental anguish as well as of physical discomfort, and young adults and teens are buying it on the streets of Anchorage in increasing numbers. Heroin comes to Alaska and the rest of the U.S. from Mexico and Colombia. Drowsiness, impaired mental abilities, slow breathing, sometimes nausea and vomiting are typical effects of the drug. Users risk heart valve infections, abscesses, skin and liver disease, pneumonia, not to mention hepatitis and AIDS. So why would anyone want to get involved with the deadly drug?
The stigma of heroin use is gone. I mean, it used to be back in the 60s where in Needle Park, you know, where people would be shooting up. And I think that stigma is gone with this younger generation that's coming up. They don't remember that. They weren't exposed to it. They don't think there's anything wrong with it. And also, if they're starting with the inhalation method, they think it's okay. You know, they're not really using heroin in the traditional way.
And where does the need start? Behavioral specialist Vicki Wells has an answer.
The easiest source is to go to the medicine cabinet. They usually get them from the family or friends' medicine cabinets.
Wells says kids swipe prescription opiate drugs like OxyContin from mom and dad. It's best to keep track of your prescriptions, she says.
And to look and see what's in that cabinet. If they have any pain medications, drugs that they no longer have a need for, to destroy that medication.
Wells says there is evidence now that opiate drug users actually suffer changes in the part of their brains that regulate normal functions. These physical brain changes among heroin users are thought to be permanent. Sergeant Lacey says a big part of the problem is the lack of treatment centers in Anchorage.
Once we put somebody in jail, if they get back out and they start using it, if there's not the treatment programs to support the arrests that we're making, then we have a problem, which is what we're having right now. I have never had so many people come to me before and say, "I just want treatment. What can I do to just get treatment?" I've arrested prostitutes that say, "I just want treatment." That's not usually what they tell me. So part of the problem is we can't handle the amount of people that we have that are addicted to heroin right now.
If treatment is needed to curb heroin use, then the origin of heroin becomes even more ironic. The drug is the concoction of a 19th century German pharmaceutical company which sought to slow rampant morphine addiction. In 1898, the Bayer Company, yes, the same people who invented aspirin, discovered how to cut morphine with certain chemicals to produce a drug which was originally intended to help morphine addicts kick their habits. Bayer even coined the name heroin and put it on the market. That market has now reached Alaska. Sergeant Rob Langendorfer with the Mat-Su Drug Unit says prescription medication fraud and heroin use are the consistent top two drug problems faced by Valley authorities during the past couple of years. Drug officials say that the crackdown on meth labs in Anchorage and the Matanuska Valley and the rise in use of prescription opiate drugs have paved the road for heroin traffic. Where that road leads next is anyone's guess. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the history of a unique island in the Aleutian Chain.
It's a 1,700-meter-high, beautiful, conical-shaped, classical volcano, but most of it's underwater.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
The U.S. Department of Education today reported that the $67 billion in federal stimulus money it has spent so far saved or created some 400,000 jobs nationally. The U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan said today that the stimulus money not only put people to work, but helped schools around the country stay afloat.
What we really tried to do was stave off an education catastrophe here, and I think it would have been an absolute national disaster had these funds not been available. And to, you know, keep teachers in the classroom, to keep education support staff working with students, which is critically needed, and to keep education reform moving forward. We talk so much about that. This is not a time when we can take a step backwards. We have to continue to push extraordinarily hard to get dramatically better and to do it with a real sense of urgency.
Alaska has also seen results, and in a report released today by the state's Department of Education and Early Development, more than 90 people are working in local schools in jobs that would not have existed without the federal assistance. The boost came through the $35 billion state fiscal stabilization fund, of which Alaska schools stand to receive $93 million. Paul Prussing, Deputy Director of Teaching and Learning Support, says Alaska has received and started distributing two-thirds of that money. He says local schools basically have kept the jobs filled by advancing money from their own resources in anticipation of the federal funds. He says that so far, applications from 21 school districts have been approved and 13 are still under review. Prussing says the rest have until 2011 to apply.
It is an open application, and I believe many districts are being very thoughtful and really making sure it's a public process in applying for these funds. And some districts were able to move that process along a little bit faster than others. And that's why I think we have some that are still out there and they're still going through the public process.
When the legislature approved receiving the stimulus money earlier this year, lawmakers made it clear to school leaders that the state would not replace the federal money once the stimulus programs run out. Prussing says so far, applicants have understood that and are treating the money as one-time grants.
Districts are going to do the best they can with them during the time of the fund that they have these funds, and then 2 years from now, adjust accordingly. And hopefully they'll either identify some other funding streams, other grant opportunities will come up, or just through people retiring.
Prussing says he expects the application process for the final third of the federal funds to open within a matter of weeks. Alaskans gave their input to top members of the Interior Department today at a Clean Energy Economic Forum in Washington, D.C. Interior Secretary Salazar and others gathered at the White House for discussions on renewable energy and climate change. Of about 200 people present, a half dozen or so were Alaskans, including Chris Rose, Executive Director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project based in Anchorage. Rose says some local issues came up, for example, the tough time small village communities and utilities have when they want to start up a renewable energy program like wind generation. Rose says the environmental impact studies required by the federal government are nearly impossible for a small village to fund.
We're certainly not against having those environmental studies before construction, but I guess the point that was made that probably hadn't really resonated with the administration yet is that Alaska really is different on things like this. When you ask a village of 500 people to do a $70,000 study, that's significant. That may not be significant for a community of 50,000 or 100,000 people. So just really pointing out issues like that that are a little bit different for the smaller communities in Alaska.
Just what the administration does with the input it received today remains to be seen. Mira Kohler, the president of the Alaska Village Electrical Co-op, says she thinks the officials also wanted help brainstorming in advance of next month's International Climate Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark.
I think it was primarily a forum for the administration to understand what some of the concerns were from the perspectives of rural communities, native lands, tribal issues, and perhaps to roll that into whatever formula they're going to move forward with.
Kohler says the administration officials present did not share specifics on their climate change agenda at Copenhagen, other than to say they hope the U.S. will become a leader in climate change issues. President Teddy Roosevelt designated Bogsloff Island as a bird reserve 100 years ago. Eventually, the small volcanic Aleutian Island became part of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge. KUCB's Ann Hillman has the story on the tiny, changeable island's history.
Edward Harriman built railroads and made millions, but by 1899, he was tired. His doctor told him to take a cruise and relax. Instead, he organized a massive scientific expedition to Alaska, complete with photographers, writers, and others, to document the entire journey. Along the way, they noticed a strange, small, bird-covered island, Bogsloff. He and other explorers took reports of the island back to Teddy Roosevelt, who 10 years later designated it as a bird reserve. It's also home to large populations of fur seals and stellar sea lions.
Apparently the island is in a place where the currents, it happened to come up in a place that helps the ocean currents swirl around it, so it's very dense food source right near the island. And the birds immediately moved in. They like nesting on these open cliffs. There are no predators. It was warm. You gotta think maybe some of these birds like to have warm feet. And tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of birds congregated on this island.
U.S. Fish and Wildlife archaeologist Debbie Corbett says the resources began attracting people to the island at least as early as the 1790s when the Russians first began to write about it. But no one ever settled there.
But it was kind of, you know, was it hot? There's no water there. It's erupting. It's kind of scary. People weren't inclined to hang out for very long.
Bogsloff is an active volcano, but geological oceanographer Jennifer Reynolds says it's significantly different than the other Aleutian volcanoes.
It's a 1,700-meter-high, beautiful, conical-shaped, classical volcano, but most of it's underwater.
It's by far the largest submarine volcano in the Aleutian chain. It starts on the ocean floor, on the edge of the Aleutian Trench. Most of the other volcanoes here started above sea level on the islands, which are part of the compacted sediment of the Aleutian Ridge. Since it started underwater, it looks different than other volcanoes.
When they erupt into water, the surface of the lava quenches or freezes immediately. And what glass is, essentially, is a solid with a liquid structure. It's as though you took the liquid and just flash froze it. And so lava that erupts underwater gets that flash frozen crust, which is looks like volcanic glass.
The water pressure also makes its eruptions less explosive. But because most of Bogsloff is underwater, it's unclear how old it actually is. Reynolds says it's at most 10,000 years old, which is about when the Aleuts began to populate the region. But no one really knows for sure.
We need to get down and take samples and see what the character of the lavas is, see if there are layers of sediment in between any of the layers of lava and tephra. Perhaps we could date the sediments, but it could be a long shot too.
What is known about the volcano is how much it changes.
And so the configuration, the shape of the island changes, the existence of hard rock domes and pinnacles changes. So the island is not permanent. This is the main feature of Bogsloff as far as habitat for birds and marine mammals goes. It's continually changing, and they're continually having to adjust to these changes.
Researchers are currently studying the animals that live on the surface of the island, and Reynolds hopes to soon work with other scientists to study what organisms are growing on the volcano beneath the surface and how they're affected by the volcano's eruptions. That research may help scientists learn how quickly benthic organisms grow back on disturbed underwater surfaces. Bogoslav was one of the first pieces of land in the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge, but unlike other areas in the refuge, it can only be visited with a permit. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The 59-foot fishing vessel Carly Renee capsized late Friday afternoon about 22 miles from Unalaska. All four crew members were safely rescued. The Carly Renee left Akutan around noon on Friday with 2,000 gallons of diesel, 20 gallons of hydraulic oil, and 30 pots on board to fish for cod. Coast Guard Lieutenant Karen Denny says that around 4 p.m., the boat began to list to the starboard side. The crew said they checked for flooding multiple times and found none.
When the vessel got to 60 degrees starboard list, the captain made a mayday call and instructed the crew to abandon ship. All crew members put on their immersion suits and deployed their life raft, got in the water, and were able to get into the life raft. The vessel then continued to have its extreme starboard list and eventually overturned.
They were soon rescued by the fishing vessel Guardian, which had heard the mayday call on the radio.
The fishing vessel Guardian came back. They doubled back. They were on their way home. They finished their quota already, and they were on their way home. But they heard the mayday call, and they turned right around and steamed right over.
Magone Marine worked with the vessel owners and the Coast Guard to try to move the vessel from where it had drifted to a safe haven in an inlet where it could be salvaged. On Sunday, they pumped the Carly Renee full of air to float it and towed it at about 2 knots. The currents pushed the bow of the boat down into the water.
Carly Renee burped some air, which was its buoyancy, and it ended up sinking in about 120 fathoms of water, which is 700 feet of water.
The vessel may not be recoverable in that depth of water. It released some oil before it sank, but Denny says it should not cause any environmental damage.
There did seem to be, eventually, a sheen came out of that, which was a half mile long and 2 miles wide, but it was really thin rainbow sheen. And not a big slick. It was like in patches, if you will.
The Coast Guard is still investigating what caused the sinking. The boat was owned by Sandra Moeller and her brother John, the governor's chief advisor on rural issues. Last week, Anchorage launched a new multi-language approach to battle domestic violence and assist victims. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
According to census figures, in 2000, 30% of Anchorage residents described themselves as non-white. 6 years later, that had risen to 36%. Many have a first language other than English. Some speak little or no English. If they've come to Anchorage to participate in its opportunities, some may find themselves sharing in the city's darker side, domestic violence. In 2008, Anchorage police received over 3,600 domestic violence reports. Now the municipality has a new service to help some of the city's non-English speaking domestic violence victims.
The language line actually is an oral recording of statutorily mandated information for victims of domestic violence.
Renee Aguilar is the interpersonal violence specialist for Anchorage's Health and Human Services Department. She oversaw the recently completed project that not only translated the Alaska statute defining mandatory victim assistance, but also how to contact agencies and organizations offering victims help. The five languages are those most common in Anchorage after English: Spanish, Samoan, Hmong, Tagalog, and Korean.
Bilang biktima ng karahasang pantahanan.
Now when Anchorage police respond to a domestic violence situation and the victim speaks only one of those five languages, the officers hand out a booklet in that language describing the victim's rights plus a telephone number for the language line message. Aguilar says the language line acknowledges a basic fact, and that makes the new outreach effort more effective.
Not everyone who speaks another language also reads that language, and so they will be able to hear it verbally over the recording line.
The department also seeks to take advantage of the fact that many immigrant households are multi-generational.
We combined an English version along with those translated versions. For example, you might have someone who only speaks and reads Spanish at home, but their children and or their grandchildren speak and read both languages, and therefore it becomes a much easier tool to use for them.
Together, the booklet and the recorded language lines reinforce the message that assistance exists to help domestic violence victims in Anchorage, who are relatively new arrivals.
Right now, there's a huge gap in terms of being able to know what their rights are, at least having a full understanding of that in their first language.
Aguilar says one unanticipated strength of the new multicultural effort is the active role being adopted by the translators themselves.
And so we consider this a partnership with these cultural communities, which is one of the reasons that we work with local translators, because they have the pulse of the local cultural community.
One way to access the language line phone numbers is to go to the KSK website, where we'll post them along with a link to the appropriate Health and Human Services Department web pages.
El programa AWAKE, AWAIC, también puede recomendar.
For KSKA, this is Len Anderson.
Sobre la violencia doméstica.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Deanna Garrison in Ketchikan, Ann Hillman in Unalaska, and Len Anderson and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com. And by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.